This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jimmy hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here, P2, on the P2 Podcast, coming to you from Trinidad World Recording Studios, my cozy, warm studio here in Fort Worth, Texas, where creativity is allowed to reign free, unrestrained. Well, folks, we have our good friend here today, becoming a frequent contributor to the podcast. He is a singer-songwriter in Texas, out there making it happen, playing a lot, booking his own shows, traveling around in a van, getting the band together, making it happen in so many different kinds of ways. He is our very own Zach Huckabee here. How's it going, Huckabee?
I'm good, Philip. How are you?
It's so good to catch up with you today.
Man, I'm glad to be here. It's an honor. It's truly an honor and a privilege. It's actually the best thing I've done all year.
Is that right?
Sitting here with you.
Yeah. Oh, man. I hope you saw a big bump in record sales, man, from your last appearance on the podcast.
Big bump.
I know I got a lot of good feedback. I think you're one of the few guys we've had that you recorded here at the studio with your band. We made a really cool record, and you were talking about it back then. What was that, like June maybe? It was like the summer, wasn't it?
Yeah, we wrapped it up in May, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And then you were in here on the podcast like last summer.
Yeah, July, something like that.
But I had a lot of people, a lot of the regular listeners who didn't know much about you was like, man, I went over and checked out that Huckabee stuff, man. You know, listened to it online or, you know, and kind of looked you up.
That's right.
So, and man, yours is a record, and I've said it before, that I do play for a lot of guys who come in and look at the studio. Kind of like, man, who have you been working on lately? You know, who came out pretty cool? It's helpful that you got good songs. It's rock and roll, so I kind of turn that record up loud. I said, man, we did this in here, you know.
That does help.
Then I just kind of watch their faces as their jaw just drops open and goes, dude,
I know.
Yes. You know.
With the face-melting guitar,
right.
You know, that kind of thing. A 1,000 guitar tracks on one song, you know, that's how we roll, man.
That's right. That's well, man, a lot has happened since the records come out. I keep hearing you on the radio, keep seeing you on the charts, man, out there moving around, introducing yourself to people, doing some radio shows.
Playing the game.
Playing the game,
playing
man.
The
Nothing
game.
Wrong with playing the game.
No, I mean, that's good. We I think we peaked at 34 on the Texas music charts.
All right, man. Which one? The Fight?
The Fight.
All right.
Doing about 17 weeks or so here lately, I'm sure. It's at the downfall right now, you know. But, you know, it's more successful than anything else I've ever put out.
Sure,
you know?
yeah.
I mean, 34 is nothing to scoff at, especially...
Was that your second album, third album?
My second album with three
second
piece.
Second studio album, right.
And, yeah, man, it was more successful than anything else that we've done, and we've already sold or given away about, you know, half or more than half of the first order of the record.
Yeah.
I'll have to be reordering here pretty soon. And, you know, it's exciting. It's exciting to finally... have something that's quasi-successful.
Well, man, it's so important just to, when you do make something, those early albums, you know, if nothing else, you know, you might not see a lot of instant radio or something, but, man, it just makes it to where when you make your next album, you know, it's just be a little more, you've learned a lot to say, man, so when you get excited about the next one and you go back there, you know, you're not just sitting there, you know, scratching at the window. Hey, man, I made this album. You kind of, hey, it's me again. We got
right.
They kind of know you. Oh, yeah, and it does open some doors. Get you used to kind of moving around and stuff.
Sure.
A lot of people think I, you know, independent Phil, the world's most fiercely independent artist, doesn't play the game. And I really don't actively, but, you know, I look back over 10 years, I know everybody. You know, I know all these guys who run the radio stations and the DJs and the clubs and the record store guys. And, you know, I've just been around. And, you know, I mean, maybe I wasn't out on a record store tour or a radio tour, but, you know, I did some gig in Nacogdoches. Hey, man, I'm the DJ from the local station. Oh, cool. And I'd give them a CD. And that adds up over a lot of years, you know, to where, you know, we put out our new album. There's several guys who I can send it to. Oh, this guy, I know this guy, I know this guy. And, you know, you just accumulate those kind of contacts. So it's important to be out there early, as you are.
I did the radio, the radio thing, you know.
Yeah.
And that's a different experience. You got a lot of artists that listen to this deal. I know.
Sure.
I listen to the podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks.
If you're an artist and you haven't done a radio thing, I mean, I really suggest that you might try that out.
Yeah.
Even if you don't have a single out. Mm-hmm. DJs are always willing to come over and have you come in and talk to them.
Sure.
Or whatever. They may not always care what you're pushing or what you're talking about, but they need it.
It breaks up the monotony of their programming.
They need it for their programming. They need live stuff. They need new people. And you know, there are a lot of folks out there who are, you know, sick of the Ragweeds and the Robert Earl Keens and stuff like that want new stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, that's what the station plays all the time.
Exactly.
So it's kind of a different thing. What always, you know, always bugged me, and I understand why, they always want you to play live in the studio.
Uh-huh.
And I realize it's a special performance of a song.
Uh-huh.
I don't, man, early on I thought it was cool. And, man, it always beat me, man. They would say, man, come on the air, come on the air. I'd go, man, do I have to play? And they're like, man, don't you want to? And for some reason, I was like, I'd rather just kind of talk about the album, play a couple songs off the record.
Yeah.
I've worked hard to make this recording. I don't know. That's probably me being a jerk or something. I'm just kind of like, I just don't know why. It's early in the morning. I'm just kind of like, dude, my guitar's in the – I just got to dig it out. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm always happy to do it, but I'm always like, man, can't I just kind of – talk about what you've been doing, play a few cuts off the album, and go on. But they always love the in-studio, you know, just me hunched around the mic trying to play while the traffic report's going on.
I think it's more of a gift to the DJs than it is anything.
That's what it is, yeah.
They may be fans of your music, and I've stumbled upon some DJs that did listen to my music and some that didn't care that I even was born.
Mm-hmm.
But you go in there and I think for the most part, like Shane at Mandatory.
Stephenville, you know, Shane Hollinger.
Yeah. Or, you know, even Brad Heitman in Stephenville, more of a top 40 station.
Sure.
I mean, they are really fans and they want to hear, you know, what you're doing. If you have a new song that you'd like to play on the air, you know, that kind of thing. So, there's actually some music fans out there that are DJs.
There are, that's
they're,
right.
They're few and far between for the most part. But a lot of them do like that live stuff. And I usually don't mind because I usually like to play the songs acoustic more than I do full band.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Because it's how they were written.
Right,
and
right.
It's more true.
More of an intimacy.
Yeah.
And easier thing to pull off, obviously, playing in a studio.
But see, I know how you write songs. So, I mean, that's not a big deal to you because you're like, okay, let's come up with a groove, and then we'll figure out words later, you know? and that works for you, but for me, it's more of an intimate thing, and then I just throw all the crap on it later
on when we get to
the studio. So.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
So, man, you out there playing a lot. Anything jump out? Any shows, any markets, new places where things are going well, where things are going extremely bad?
Oh, man. You know. I'm still new, even though I've been on the road for years. I'm still a new artist and people are relatively unaware of who I am, which is fine. But you know, it's all hit or miss, man. We do our best to promote Facebook and MySpace and all that crap and put videos up and new songs and that kind of thing. But really, I mean, there's the Belton area.
Is
becoming to be.
Now, where do you play up there? Because I've heard some guys playing up there.
There's a place called the Dead Fish.
The Dead Fish.
Used to be called Frank's Lakeview Inn. It used to be kind of a bad,
joint. Where's that from? 35?
35? It's by the lake. It's down by the lake. It's kind of tricky to explain how to get there.
Yeah.
But if you Google it and you're in that area, definitely put it in your TomTom or GPS.
So it's kind of a lakeside tavern kind of deal.
Yeah, okay. And it's real cool. It's laid back, and the crowd's usually pretty cool, and yeah. And you know, the food's good, and we get free drinks, so that's nice.
Yeah.
But no, we kind of have built up a little following there, much due to my new band members, Jason Glass.
Oh, so they're from out
Jonathan
there.
Wozinski. They both live there.
I see.
And so they've pulled some good crowds for us. But man, that's been the real deal. And you know, there's some crowds that have kind of fallen off, and I picked some up. You know, College Station, I picked a few crowds up. You know,
we've been playing down there.
Shotsies.
Yeah, that's a good place.
And
to play.
You know, it's kind of fallen off for me in San Angelo a little bit at Blaine's, but you know, because of all the new other clubs that have opened up in town. And
yeah, is there a lot going on in San Angelo these days?
Well, it's college town.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's a big cowboy town, you know.
Steel Penny Pub still there?
Steel Penny's there.
Is that a cool place to play?
Well,
I've never been in there.
I've just played exclusively at Blaine's because we have a kind of a contract and a deal, and I've been playing there for years. Man.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, the crowds change.
The legendary. We got to give somebody the history of Blaine's.
Yeah, well, Blaine Martin opened the pub in, I believe, 94.
Yeah.
And that was the stop. That was a Texas music stop.
Oh, man. Everybody, it didn't matter how. I mean, Pat Green would go out there.
Pat Green.
With three buses and still. Play Blaine's.
Jack Ingram, Robert O'Keefe.
Oh yeah.
All the old greats like Johnny Bush and all the old honky tonkers. Everybody would play Blaine's, and then Blaine Martin sold the club about 3 or 4 years ago, and it got taken over by somebody else, and they changed the format up a little bit, and people really came to Blaine's to see Blaine Martin because he had like a real gruff voice, you know, and. He was
the biggest unmissable guy in the place.
Yeah, and it didn't matter how loud it was, you always heard that gruff voice.
Yeah.
And he told me when I first started playing there, he said, Zach, as long as you don't suck, you can play here. So that was kind of a nice little pep talk he gave me, and I tried not to do that, though some nights I probably did. And
he's a mentor for you there.
Yeah, he was a mentor. And,
that's right.
Anyway, he unfortunately passed away about a year ago.
Is that right? I don't know if I knew that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I knew that. I knew he'd sold the club.
Yeah, he passed away, you know.
Now that you say that, that sounds – and I heard he was real sick.
Yeah. It was in his sleep. It was completely –
That's too bad, yeah.
Completely cool, you know. But he was a pretty neat individual.
Yeah, unique. It's characters like that drive this whole deal.
Yeah.
I started playing, you know, we did our early Dallas shows at Poor David's Pub.
Yeah.
In Dallas. I'm just a Dallas stalwart since the early 70s. And David Card was in there. He was the guy you went to see, you know. He just, you know, drank all day. I mean, he stayed there and watched every show of the opening act, he was there the whole time.
Yeah.
He was there for sound check, and he was there when he paid you out at 2:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And all points in between. I mean, he'd seen everybody play Poor David's. I mean, he'd just tell stories about, you know, Lyle Lovett and Robert Earl Keen. I mean, everybody had been in there and done it and played at some point.
Mm-hmm.
The Dixie Chicks. I mean, the list goes on forever. And so, you know, when he did as wild and crazy and much of a character as he was, you couldn't help but really perk up when he was like, you know what you remind, you know, you kind of remind me of this, or, you know, you do this well, or maybe this is what you need to work on. Hell, the first time Lovett was in here, he didn't know how to, it was good to have that perspective. There wasn't a lot of people I was around, especially in kind of college towns where a bunch of 23-year-olds own all these bars, typically.
Yeah.
So to kind of get an old school guy who'd kind of seen them all at the same, spot careers, I always couldn't help but perk up and kind of take some of his words to heart a little bit, you know, because I was like, well, this guy, he sat on the stool drinking, watching me, and he sat on the stool drinking, watching, you know, Lovett or, you know,
that's a dying breed too, man. I've been playing bars for a while.
Right.
And you know, there's just not as many owners that really give a crap about that stuff anymore. I mean, it's really all about the bottom dollar, and it's not really about anybody who loves music anymore. If you're a bar owner and you're listening to this, which I don't know of any that care enough about music to listen to this, but if you're listening to this, it's always nice to watch the bands that you book.
Yeah, right,
you know,
right.
If the guy who books you is never even there to watch any of your shows, that's kind of a disheartening situation because it's like, you know, What is he booking me off of?
Well, I want to talk about that's interesting you bring that up because we had a big discussion. The band and I were out playing in Lubbock and Amarillo this past week and had been out there about a year. Had a great time. And but I tell you what, I was really struck by a couple of things Slowly but surely, I become more like David Card over the years. But, you know, like you, man, I got going about your age just yeah. playing all the time, you know. Mm. And so I want to talk about kind of the attitude of maybe young people these days, music. You talk about bar owners. Maybe there's not a lot of guys who are just that into it. I think there's something to be said for that. So that's going to be a topic for our middle section.
Okay.
Bars, everything from attitudes of younger people now, and also you know, how bars and everything have had to react to recent trends, recent laws, and everything from the smoking ban to all that kind of stuff. We're going to talk about that. You know, the changing, you know, club scene maybe here in the last few years. Some stuff Zach's talking about, and from my a bit older perspective, we'll talk about that in our next segment. Stay tuned. Now I understand what they mean to me. I understand what they mean to me. Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast. Guiding your chaotic music life through the fog. Seek the light. Go toward the light in the fog. Find yourself to the harbor. That's where we are. Email me at phil@philpritchett.com. Book the full band. And the new record, Mark of the Human Hand, is out there. Zach Huckabee's over there just rapidly pulling the shrink wrap off his new copy of it. thanks for all your feedback on the record. I've gotten a lot of emails. I always encourage people to say, hey, this song's cool, or this one. It gives us a lot of feedback as we go out and play shows. Well, Zach was talking about, you know, we're talking about kind of Blaine out there, you know, Blaine's Pub in San Angelo, poor David. Those old school dudes, you know, that were just so into the music. Zach kind of made a observation that maybe that's not as common maybe as it was. Maybe those guys are kind of a dying breed. Which was interesting, and I wanted to throw this at you, Huckabee, as a guy playing a lot. That's what you had to be, it seemed like, early on. You had, just to even own a bar and have bands in there, it was kind of a labor of love. It was, you had to deal with fixing the PA, the bands calling you all the time, the booking, the getting there early, letting them sound check. Bitching about the monitor mixes. I mean, you had to put up with all that. If you're a club owner, you had to really like to sit there and listen to the bands, and that'd be a real part of your deal. I think what's happened in recent years is Texas music kind of took off, and people were like, man, if we have a band in here, like, you know, that Ragweed, whatever the hell it is, you know, these guys are going to just pack it in, and we're going to have all these people here. It became more of a business, maybe. And, man, I wonder... when I was, just to give some perspective of where all this is coming from and where we're headed, when I was in college, man, that was like the early 90s, we'd go to 6th Street in Austin. I mean, it was, you know, I just fell in love with music with David Garza and Soul Hat and Ian Moore and Little Sister, all these bands. Man, they just played for like $2 or $3 in these little bars on 6th Street, Dollar Pabst Blue Ribbon. You know what I'm saying? You go out for $12. Mm-hmm. Live music was a big bang for your buck. You could just drink. And, dude, every one of these places, and I'm not saying this is good or bad, but it's the way it was. It was just a wink-wink. You know, you just kind of grabbed an ID from somebody. It wasn't that stringent. That there were kind of your underage places.
Oh, yeah.
When we played Poor David's Pub, man, we would sell 200 tickets. I mean, it'd be out the door. And, man, there'd be kids in there from high school, which was a bad situation sometimes. But they were still paying $10 to get in there to see us, or $5 or whatever. Right. And, man, it was just this huge scene. And, man, we went out and saw music all the time. That was just what you did in your early 20s. You went out and saw bands, and it was easy to get in. It was cheap. It was easy to get a beer. You could smoke if you – I mean, it was just – the world was wide open. And I would say today, without question, there have been gigantic roadblocks thrown up against that. You've got a lot of corporate venues out there. The big one is the drinking laws. Man, whereas poor David or somebody may have been able to look the other way in the mid to late 90s if some guys were in there. Now, dude, those dudes just get hammered by a what is it?
The TABC.
Well, you know, it's just they just go, dude. I mean, the last few times at Port Davis and some of these places where some of that was going on, man, they would just have super security there. They're just going to do, we cannot have one person in this bar. And it used to be a lot of these places, even though they weren't carding real heavily, maybe they would. You could be 18 or you could be 16 and just put an X on your hand, but they'd still pay a ticket.
Yeah.
You know, and man, all that is gone. All of that has disappeared. And man, I mean, because we had a lot of high school fans in Dallas or in Fort Worth, or I mean, guys that would still come to the shows and just get an X on their hand. Those days are finished. Not only that, you come in there, you've got to be 21 or up. You come in there, oh yeah, well, you can't have more than maybe one or two beers. Hell, you got to drive home, right? You know, that's gotten more difficult. And plus, you can't smoke anymore. I mean, we used to play Scruffy Murphy's in Waco. I mean, it was just choked with smoke and full of kids with X's on their hands who are smoking and may or may not be having a beer. And man, there's just no doubt that that was a big part of who even wanted to go to these types of places.
Right.
Nowadays, we need over 21 people who aren't going to drink a lot and who don't smoke. And don't tell me that isn't hard, man, to get a crowd.
Yeah.
Do you see that?
I see it. Yeah, I mean, I want to mention that I don't condone, and I know Philip doesn't either, you know, underage drinking. But you know, you're right. I mean, if you make it 21 and up, I'm all for giving people the benefit of the doubt. You know,
right.
let's say there's an 18-year-old who's just a staunch music lover,
mm-hmm.
like I was at 18,
yeah.
And I'm not going to go into a bar and jeopardize getting kicked out for buying a beer.
Yeah, or arrested, right.
Or arrested. Yeah. So, but TABC is making it extremely difficult on some people, which you know, just a few bad apples spoils the bunch is basically what it boiled down to. But
man, lawsuits too. I mean, you hear about something happening. You know, some kid leaves your bar and falls off the curb and busts his head open, man, you can get sued. And so there's a tremendous amount, and that has just been ratcheted up since I got going, more and more with each passing year as there are incidences and laws get passed. And man, it is very difficult. And as a result, more of the thing to do is, I mean, if I was 20 years old, You just put a keg on your back porch and play video games.
Yep.
It's risky, man. So drive all the way to downtown Dallas, park your car, it's expensive.
Yeah.
And potentially dangerous. And your chances of going to jail for having a beer or having something in your pocket and stuff goes up exponentially. So I think, I wonder if the younger people that are now 18, 19, 20, 21, are even interested or being trained to like go out and see bands. Like, that's a cool thing. I don't think that's nearly as true as it was when I was young. That was the thing to do.
It's not even as true as it was back 3 years
ago. Wouldn't you say that's probably true?
3 or 4 years ago, I remember when Pat Green was doing his deal. We used to follow that guy around everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it was, we were just,
you could get in.
Following.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
We could get in and me and my buddy Tony and we would just follow that cat around, and we would go to all these live music venues just to see everybody we could.
Yeah, that's right.
We went to Green Hall and saw all these big festivals and Pat Green's festival and just everywhere we could go every weekend.
That's right.
Broken Spoke in Austin, we'd go see Gary P. Nunn just, you know, on a whim or whatever.
Sure.
But now, I mean, I just don't think that. I just don't think people care enough.
No,
you know?
Music just doesn't. The scene is not there. It's out elsewhere. I was kind of comparing it to, this is kind of a loose comparison, but it's somewhat similar to maybe like the late '60s, where you kind of had, where really the psychedelic drugs and stuff was kind of a new thing, and you know, college kids and high school kids were really into it. Man, you had all these festivals and bands kind of spring up. Sure, they had good music and stuff, but it was built around a certain sort of fun time culture thing that was really happening, that was new, and no one really. But man, as as you know, acid became illegal and drug laws began to really crack down, man, don't think that didn't affect it. In fact, it killed off the whole thing. And maybe it's, you could say it wasn't sustainable anyway. But as dudes started going to jail, man, serving hard time for having acid and for having drugs and stuff like that, and bands started making money on festivals. It just eventually the scene goes away, man. It, as the law catches up, and the honeymoon's over, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I think you're right, man. I think when the Texas music thing really kind of caught on there in the late 90s, early 2000s, man, it was still, man, and we benefited from it. I mean, we would just go play places like in Nacogdoches for like 500-600 people, paying $10 a head.
Right.
And, you know, if you really went around and saw, made sure everybody was 21 and didn't have more than two beers and couldn't smoke, you wouldn't have anybody in there. So you're stacked up against a lot when you go out these days.
Well, and that's one thing. And the other thing is the, this music now, the Texas music in general, especially the top 20 on the Texas charts, really caters to the 12 to 18-year-olds.
Yeah, oh, there's no question about it.
You know, so if you have no venue for those people to go, they're going to take your records and put them on the back porch and with a keg that somebody's cool dad bought and sit and play beer pong or drink Keystone or smoke Dubes, you know, on the back porch and listen to that record and say, man, I really like that guy. Too bad we can't go see him. And then when they become 18, 19 years old and they actually start thinking, then they're like, that music just doesn't really do anything for me anymore.
Yeah, no.
And that's where we catch them, Phil.
That's right. Where can I go sit, have a cup of coffee at 1 a.m. and watch some good music? It's very different, man. And it was obvious. I mean, all those bands, ourselves included, who gave us money? I mean, we didn't get money from record labels. We got money from beer companies. You know, Budweiser, Miller Lite, they would quote-unquote, you know, they'd sponsor bands. They're like, look, man, wherever Pat Green goes, he's got people drinking, young drinkers. We'll give him X amount of dollars, big, huge dollars.
Yeah.
People have no idea, man. I mean, you're talking hundreds of thousands sometimes.
Yeah.
To a band or a couple of bands. And because they're selling beer, man, and that was part of it. And, man, that is, as the laws, again, have gotten more stringent and stuff, it's less useful for a band. You're not going to reach that demographic. Sure. You don't have those young drinkers in there anymore. So a lot of those contracts have just gone away. No one has a beer sponsorship.
You just don't
anymore.
See
you have a couple. You still got some big guys with some beer posters and things like that. But man, not like it was there for a little while.
Yeah, for a long time it was beer company. You know, Lone Star Light. You know, Shiner Bock. Everybody was sponsoring different people.
Yeah, man, you could give a band $10,000 and just have your beer under their name on every poster in every bar in the state, you know? They say, man, they're getting a good flow of people in there. Yeah. But it's a difficult game to play, man, especially when you go to like Lubbock or College Station, these college towns where we've always done well. Man, it's just there's just no one in there under 21. Where we used to get, you know, freshmen and sophomores in college would come see us play. Now that's just absolutely impossible. So it hurts you pretty bad, man.
Sure.
It's just a big bite. Not only that, everybody wants to stay outside so they can smoke cigarettes and can't smoke inside. And it's very interesting, man. It's almost a head scratcher on where it's headed. You're kind of like, man, where are people going to go play?
Yeah, who knows?
Beer swilling, you know, cigarette smoking, rock and roll. Where's that going to be happening? Or is it just like the acid days of yore? Woodstock? Is it just over?
That's true, man. I don't really have any idea.
I don't either.
The only hope for musicians is to keep producing.
Yeah.
You know, keep putting stuff out there.
Right.
And also to diversify their game. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you can. Yeah. I don't know. Without giving too many secrets away, you know.
Sure.
You want to get out there. You want to do your kind of music. But
sure.
If your kind of music doesn't cater to everybody, try something else.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Like I've got my record out. You know, and I'm sure that I'm gonna put out some sort of a an acoustic record, you know. And that's going to get, you know, maybe some thinkers involved. And then, you know, I also dabble in, like, writing Christian songs for a Christian band.
Sure.
You know? And so, you know, if you kind of diversify your market and, and really, and this is a business, you know, it's like everything else.
Well, yeah.
You know,
it has to be at some point. You've got it. The trick is we're all willing to, as I say, man, you got to be willing to work for it. You got to be willing to work for it. We're all willing to work for it. The trick is making it work for you at some point. That's the whole trick. And that's the difference between the guys who can keep going and the guys who just can't.
Yeah. I mean,
sleeping on it, just because you're willing to sleep on the pool table and drive all night, you've got to make it pay. You got to come home with $100.
After
your expenses. You just have to at some point.
There's a time, man, where, I don't know, I think you just grow out of playing five nights a week.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's fun. I love playing music.
Right.
I love it. But do I want to play five nights a week when I'm 50 years old?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah,
I don't.
Right.
That's the answer. And, you know, would I rather be writing and maybe producing records or just throwing stuff out on iTunes for my fans to buy?
Sure.
Probably.
Yeah.
I would
rather
do that and dabble in some other aspects of this business than, you know,
just pounding
the roads, you know, because that makes you old before your time. And Robert Robertson said you can't do it. It's an impossible way of life.
That's right.
And it's true.
Yeah, it is.
You know, and that's the hard truth about it. And if you see those old road dogs out there, like still playing, John D. Graham.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Just look at that
Lots
guy.
Of them, yeah.
Look at him and listen to him talk.
It's a long deal.
That's a hard road. It's a hard deal. And if you look at the other guys, like if you look at your George Straits or whatever, and you don't really know much about the music business, those cats have it easy on the road. He tours for maybe four months at a time.
Straight plays about 12 dates a year.
He tours around in Prevost buses. He doesn't have to load anything, doesn't have to unload anything.
No.
He's got the most plush environment you could possibly play in.
Yeah.
The same goes with like Eric Clapton and all those guys.
Sure.
And it's rough because I just got through reading his autobiography.
Great autobiography. I read that as well. Yeah.
But he did a year-long tour from, I think it was from March to March. You know, but you know, you got to think how this guy travels. You know, he's at the top. He is in a bus. He's playing stadiums where everybody wants to hear him every night.
That's right.
And he's not playing at Woody's for 15 people, and 11 of which could care less that his mother gave birth to him. You know,
right.
So,
well, man, let's get into the vault here.
Okay.
In our final segment, let's do just that. We've talked about movies in the vault. We've talked about, of course, many great albums. Let us explore the Clapton autobiography, because I have a lot of questions I want to ask you about it. We've both read it.
Okay.
Our first book in the vault, Clapton, the autobiography.
I'm honored.
When we come back.
Hey, this is Zach Huckabee with the Zach Huckabee Band. You're listening to the legendary P2, Mr. Phil Pritchett, on the P2 Podcast.
Welcome back, fans, Romans, countrymen. Lend me your ears. Well, if you know anything about P2, Phil Pritchett and the Full Band, we never do the same album twice. We always try to. We do live, we do acoustic, experimental, rock and roll. Sure, it's all got kind of the same core to it, but we stretch it out. We do the same here on the podcast. Always doing a first. We have the coveted, the analytical, the insightful Pritchett. What's on Phil's iPod? The vault section. Always looking at albums. We strayed from that convention a while back to talk about the great movie The Last Waltz and the greatest film ever made. This is Spinal Tap. Now we're going to break with even that tradition. The vault, what do we got in there? The Clapton autobiography. Zach Huckabee is here today. How's it going, Zach?
I'm very good.
Yeah, good, man.
Very good.
Well, you started talking about the Clapton biography, made a few references. I read it last, did it come out last Christmas? Or two Christmas. Someone gave it to me for Christmas.
I think it was 2007 it came out.
Yeah, I got somebody bought it for me for Christmas, and I read it. So it's a quick, easy read.
It's
it's such
that.
A chaotic life, but you know, you can read it in a few days. Maybe not that quick, but Very interesting, man. I've read every rock and roll autobiography or biography I can get my hands on within reason about any guys. I just find it always fascinating. It's always inspiring.
It is.
They're always in their car. They're sleeping on the floor. Nothing's going good. And all of a sudden, bam.
Yeah.
Roxanne was on the top of the charts. You know, and there we were, you know. The Police or what? Just, you know, things happen. It gives you a little sense of like, man, you know, we can all just keep going. And who knows what happens. But a lot of insight into their struggles. And, you know, guys like you and me are out there trying to play music for a living. I think it's good to know. You know, we see some dude on TV and he just got it all going on, you know, and he says, oh man, well shit, he's got this and this and this. You kind of read his backstory, man, there's always a lot there, a lot of, you know, a lot of struggle, a lot of hardship overcome, a lot of practice, a lot of people telling them they were no good. That's a part of any success story, and so it's always very inspiring. So yeah, we got old Eric Clapton, British-born guitar player. From sort of a proper British background, right? Sounded like?
Yeah,
sort of.
Middle class British,
you know,
background. Yeah.
Not like the Beatles. He wasn't a roughneck.
No, he wasn't.
He was a little more proper, and starts playing guitar, and gets hooked on heroin, gets huge, and now he tours arenas. Did I leave anything out?
Yeah, a lot.
Well, give us a little more in depth. What strikes you about the Clapton autobiography?
Well, I mean, first off, I mean, his whole life was just terrible.
Yeah.
Whether by his intervention or by somebody else's. I mean, he was born to a really young mother, teenage mother.
That's right.
Grandparents raised him. Mm-hmm. Mom didn't have anything to do with him.
Right.
At one point, he asked his mom when she came back into his life when he was, you know, growing up, said, can I call you mom? She said, no.
Yeah.
You know, so that really tore him up.
How often we hear the estranged parents story in these rock and roll guys deal.
But then, you know, he started playing guitar. That was kind of his outlet. He wasn't very good in school.
Right.
He didn't like any of that. And he started hanging out kind of at these trendy blues places, mm-hmm. beatnik type places.
Really into the blues at a young age.
And he'd listen to the old records from America and play guitar and landed this gig with this band called the Yardbirds.
Yeah.
And he played with them because he wanted to be traditional blues.
Right.
He wanted to keep it traditional blues. And they were...
Well, the Yardbirds before is John Mayall deal.
Mayall
was right after that, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Somewhere. Okay.
So he's playing the Yardbirds, and he thought they were keeping it traditional. And,
the Yardbirds, of course, also had Jeff Beck. Was he the first guy they had?
No. Clapton was the first guy they had.
Okay.
Yeah,
then they later on had Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Yardbirds known for those great three guitar players who all played British British blues came out of there.
But then he did the record with the Yardbirds, made them hugely popular.
Yeah.
Then he quit because they were going in a more poppy direction.
Yeah.
And he was like,
forget
that.
Right.
Left, found John Mayall. He needed a guitar player. Jumped
on
with John Mayall because he was staying traditional blues. Made John Mayall and the Blues Breakers with Eric Clapton, that record. And that launched John Mayall into great success.
Right.
And then he quit.
And at this time, Clapton really known, especially in the Mayall years, was starting to be known as... the great guitar player, Clapton is God, all that kind of stuff.
That's where they used a small combo amp in recording.
Uh-huh.
The actual Marshall Blues Breaker is what they used in that recording session, and that's.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know
that's
that.
The first time they didn't use like huge, you know, amplifiers
Marshall,
to record.
Yeah.
Then he got on with Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce and
forming
Cream.
Cream.
Yeah. And so they had great success there, and Clapton said that he never really got into drugs or did anything, you know, until he was hugely successful with Cream.
With Cream. Well, Cream was, superstar band. I mean, you know, Yardbirds, Blues Breakers, cool, but traditional blues.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're in the late 60s, man, blues, just, it became more mainstream. People were looking for that stuff.
Yeah.
And, of course, injecting that blues and that psychedelic thing they had going on in Cream. And they had big hit songs, man.
Sure.
They had tunes. Of course, White Room and...
Sunshine of Your Love.
Sunshine of Your Love.
And they had just phenomenal songs, and they were all great musicians with impeccable voices and just the whole nine yards. They had it.
Yeah.
And then he did that, and then he broke up with Cream, got into Blind Faith.
Right. Stevie Winwood. Ginger Baker also again on drums, wasn't he?
Yeah, that was the only condition that Stevie Winwood would come in, as if Ginger Baker played drums.
Right.
And Eric Clapton didn't like that very much. They had the bass player.
People will know the Blind Faith album cover. with the naked girl with
naked
the airplane.
Naked redhead, airplane.
And that's a crazy record. I've got it over there.
Yeah.
Of course, you've got Can't Find My Way Home is the biggest hit everybody would know. But some killer covers on there and just jams and long drum solos and real loose. They just there's like six songs on the album. It's just like one afternoon at Clapton's house or something, and this is Blind Faith. You know what I mean? It's just it's so refreshing. I go, man, what's so cool about Clapton was his willingness just to kind of move around, try new things. It didn't matter. These days, bands, they get a little success, and man, but we need to make this kind of record because people are expecting this from us, and we got to keep the band together. There's not a lot of willingness to just go off into the woods because, man, people will forget about us, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that also plays into people striking while the iron is hot, so to speak.
Yeah.
You're like, man, they had a little success. How come they're just doing a Levi's commercial, a Gap commercial, a Mercedes commercial, hosting Saturday Night Live, and they're in the new Austin Powers movie? You're like, well, they feel like when they had a little success, the clock is ticking.
Right.
And then you take it all. And I think a lot of the talented guys out there would do well to maybe look at Clapton and say, man, I'm going to take it a little slower. I'm going to step out of it a little bit and rush things. I don't know. Maybe that wouldn't work today.
Well, with Clapton, this whole thing wasn't ever about money. And what was funny about that is that his estate that he still lives in, the Hurtwood estate. You know,
he's had that forever,
right? It was during Cream. Yeah, right. He had a financial manager. And he saw Hurtwood, and he said, man, I guess it's probably time that I buy like a house or something. And he said, I really had no idea how much money I had.
Yeah, that's
right. And I was like, hey, I'd like to buy this. And the financial manager wrote a check for the amount of money for the huge estate of Hurtwood. You know, and he's like, oh, that's pretty cool.
Well,
so,
cool.
You know,
right.
You know, I live there, and you know, that was our practice pad. That's you know, we did everything. And it was cool, and then he kind of, you know, on and off again relationship with Patty Harrison, George Harrison's ex-wife,
famously stole her from George Harrison.
Yeah.
Those two remained friends though through it all.
Yeah, and then the heroin thing happened before he actually hooked up with Patty, and he got hooked on heroin and was
always a big drinker.
Yeah.
Clapton really struggled with alcohol as well.
But the heroin lasted for like 3 or 4 years. He checked himself into rehab, got clean off of heroin, then jumped into drinking, and was a full-blown alcoholic for about 20 years.
Some really dark passages in that book where he really open about it, like any recovering addict. It's a real addict story, that book, passed about halfway, and is very open, very, very confessional. And real compelling, man. It gives a lot of insight into who he is, just the person, you know. He just what's really amazing is he seems like a guy in interviews and stuff that just seems to think a lot of himself, to have a huge ego, and he probably does. But really, reading the book, he doesn't come across like that. And he's so insecure, and he doesn't think he's nearly as good as Buddy Guy or he has such reverence for other guitar players and other people, and just says, man, I'm just copying these other guys. And I don't know, maybe for the sake of the book he was trying to come across as very humble, but it seemed very genuine, at least to me. I go, man, it's funny that he's just so, oh shucks, I can't do anything right, and you know, I tried this and it wasn't any good, but oh well, it sold a lot. And you know, he has a lot of attitude toward that about his own career.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't really, when I watch the interviews and stuff, I don't really see him as an arrogant guy. But he's you know, he's very gracious, especially now in his later years, having young artists that he knows are better than him to come on stage.
Sure.
Going on tour with Robert Cray and Derek Trucks and Doyle Bramhall II.
Oh, man.
And all that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, bringing those guys to the forefront and saying,
look
at these
guys.
Yeah, especially playing head to head with Derek Trucks.
Oh, man.
I
went and saw him. You and I talked about it. I went to that Clapton show in Dallas, and I knew who Derek Trucks was. His uncle was Butch Trucks, the Allman Brothers, a drummer.
Yeah.
So kind of Trucks had grown up around there, and I went and saw Derek Trucks recently at the Granada in Dallas. But first time I saw him was with Clapton a couple years ago at that big American Airlines show. And this guy comes out with an SG and a slide, and just, I mean, he's standing there next to Clapton. I'm like, dude, why would Eric Clapton, one of the great guitar players of the world, let this guy get on stage? I mean, you know, he can't hardly keep up with this young guy. It's incredible. But it was a real testament to Clapton, and he said so in his book. He just goes, man, I feel that people need to see these other guys play. And God, it was amazing. And he does the same with his guitar festival, the Cotton Bowl, a few years back. Man, he was on stage with Buddy Guy and Jimmy Vaughn and Robert Cray. And I tell you what, at least for me watching that video, if there's a DVD out there, what's it called? The Crossroads Guitar.
Crossroads, yeah. There's
Guitar
two
Festival.
Of them.
You can find them.
Yeah.
And Clapton looked very, very pedestrian up there to me.
Yeah.
Watching, you know, in his little shorts, tennis shorts, and his playing the blues.
Yeah.
And then Buddy Guy lays into one. And man, Robert Cray, and then Jimmy Vaughn, and then Clapton kind of. He kind of seems very proper and British compared to these. You know, Texas and that.
Yeah.
And that was my take on it. Just playing raw blues. I'm not talking playing his hits, but, you know, a little bit. I was like, man, and Clapton said as much after the show. He just kind of goes, man, you know, playing raw blues, I can't hold a candle to these guys.
Yeah.
That's why they're up there.
Well, especially, I mean, yeah, Jimmy Vaughn, that's definitely his only strong suit is he knows how to play the raw blues.
Right.
It's definitely not for my taste. I'm not a fan.
Man, me neither.
But
Clapton says he's his favorite guitar player.
Yeah.
Blues guitar player, Jimmy Vaughn.
I met him.
Jimmy Vaughn. Yeah.
At a Holistic Doctor in Austin.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Now, I used to see him in the music stores, Austin's Vintage Guitars, with his you know, pompadour hair. He'd pull up in like a 57 convertible Cadillac. You know what I mean? He had with like flames on the side.
It was funny. My wife, I was sitting there in the waiting room with my wife, and my wife looked over and she goes, check out that guy.
He just looks like an old
rockabilly
dude.
And I looked over and I was like,
dude, that's Jimmy Vaughn.
Like my jaw dropped, you know, even though I'm not a fan. I mean, you know, hell, it's the closest bloodline I've ever got to Stevie Ray.
Yeah,
know?
Right.
So I shook his hand and said, hey, you know.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you, you know. Jimmy.
Yeah.
He didn't really care about me, but, you know.
Yeah.
The hell, you know.
But, man, a lot of Clapton, dude, was always very noticeably held a lot of esteem for his other guitar players, mm-hmm. giving guys a chance and things like that. A couple really things I'm just now I'm sitting here thinking about the book. I haven't thought about it in about a year. One real heartbreaking scene that he, I mean, it's hard to write something like this. It was the time where he said he was trying to get sober, but he went ahead and, you know, he found a bottle and drank the whole thing.
Yeah.
And he tried to go fishing.
Yeah.
And there's a long detailed passage about how he's trying to go fishing. There's all these old guys fishing in this little pond. And he said he was so drunk, he kept hooking himself in his clothes, and he fell down, and he just was all tangled up in his fishing line.
Yeah.
People were trying to help him, and he was like cussing at him. He just goes, man, I was just so pathetic. It was really, really heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really revealing a lot. I mean, there was no one there to see. I mean, he didn't have to share that afternoon with his readers. But the fact that he did that makes the book very, very compelling, you know. And it spends a lot of part of the book talking about his recovery and his new lease on life and his, where is it? In Antigua. He's built a huge, a really nice.
The Crossroads Rehabilitation
Crossroads
Center.
Crossroads Rehabilitation Center. And,
yeah.
All these Crossroads Guitar Show, all the money goes to pay for that facility down there where guys can go to get sober and learn more about their life.
The one thing that I thought was heartbreaking in the book.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, you know, he lost his son, and everybody knows about
right.
that.
Oh, yeah,
of course, I don't want to dwell on that. But
right.
the most heartbreaking part of the story, and when you're a guitar player and you own your guitars, they have a little piece of
right.
you. You know,
man, yeah.
I've never sold anything that I've ever had, just because it all tells a story.
Sure.
And he sold Blackie.
Yeah.
They auctioned Blackie off his early 70s model Stratocaster that he played on
everything. Yeah.
And he sold Blackie, and it brought in $959,000 at auction.
Yeah.
And then he also it was the first really good guitar that he got. It was that red Gibson ES-335.
Yeah, that's right. From
that
Green
he also
and,
sold.
Yeah.
It was from the Yardbirds from the Blues Breakers record and the whole nine yards. And he sold that one, and that brought in I think $500,000 or $700,000, something like that.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, he wept in the book. I would have been crying.
Yeah, right.
Like buckets if that happened to me. You know,
man. There's a great passage in there. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast. We're talking about guitars, but gosh, because when he did come up with the Yardbirds, he was playing like the hollow body Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
Played an SG a lot with Cream.
Cream.
And so kind of around that time, he went to a music store, and a guy, he just said there was some dude who just had Strats just piled to the ceiling. And he was like, man, what do you want for all these Fender Strats? He said it was seen as kind of an old 50s Buddy Holly thing. Like he said the real thing people were playing were like Gibsons and hollow bodies
Gretches,
and Rickenbackers, Gretches.
Yeah.
So he goes, man, they were very out of fashion at the time. And but they, he said, you know, something spoke to me about him. And he buys like 10 of them or something for like $100 or something. Yeah. It was just something like, what? Just the slap, you know, just the necks and the bodies. They're all beat up and various. And he built Blackie, mm-hmm. and doesn't he have a Brownie also?
Yeah, well, he sold that one too.
Yeah, he took a couple and put nice pickups in them because I got a couple of them really up for playing weight. And he said the rest of them I just kind of had set up normally for my tours. And but man, he just bought. Of course, you look at how much a 50s Strat goes today with an original neck or a 60s. I mean, it just makes you just go, oh my gosh. I mean, you know, and you know, he just sold them for millions and millions, of course, because he was Eric Clapton. But even if he wasn't Eric Clapton, those guitars would be worth,
sure,
you know.
Well, he gave one to Pete Townsend, and he gave one to the, and then it's funny because he gives one to Pete Townsend, and that's the only guitar Pete Townsund plays after playing Les Pauls and Rickenbackers
his whole
career.
Yeah.
And he gave one to somebody else who also plays, you know, Strats now all the time. So it's pretty interesting.
Well, Eric Clapton gives you a guitar, you need to play it.
You might hold on to that.
Might hold on to it. Yeah, dude. I mean, he was just guy. He was just such a cool guy. You know, very, very quiet. And despite his, what was really unique about Clapton is he just had an ear for a good tune. More than I think, and I think that frustrates him in some way. I know he's grateful for the life it's given him, but I think he longs to be an anonymous blues purist. And it was almost like he couldn't help but being a part of these, you know, he covers I Shot the Sheriff, you know.
Yeah.
And it was amazing how he talked about making his records in that book, because he goes, man, we came together. He never was a big writer, per se. Like, he'd write one song, and then Winwood would bring a couple in. He goes, you know, he played in the living room for 2 days, and that was the record. And I Shot the Sheriff was huge. He just kind of, he would just have all these huge hits, man. Yeah. To this day, he'd do the J.J. Cale songs, and they would just blow up, and they were just old blue, but man, it always worked for him, man. He had big hits, of course, where a lot of the blues guitarists, John D. Graham or something, yeah, they're just, you choose that life, you're sworn to just kind of to play roadhouses.
That's right.
But, you know what I mean? But Clapton just, he just couldn't get out of its way. And it's afforded him a chance to, and maybe only later in life did he really realize, you know, with his recovery and Antigua, how to really maybe make that all work for him and for other people. You know, but it's a neat story.
That is, in effect, in a way, he is just a purist, because it's never been about the money.
Right.
It's never been like, hey, I got to make a record to make some money. It was always like,
It's very apparent he's a guy who doesn't know how much he has. Throughout the book,
he said, I just want to go in and make a record. And you know, he said, I wanted to make this record. He said, we got together to make a record. And we had no idea what we were going to do. We started jamming on some Robert Johnson tunes.
Yeah,
and we just made this record about me and Robert Johnson. Mm-hmm. You know,
that's right.
And it's just funny because he was on vacation, sailing the Mediterranean for a month. On a 150 or 160 foot yacht, and he said, I really like this. And my business partner came up to me and said, you should buy this boat.
Yeah.
And Clapton said, okay, let's buy this boat.
Right.
You know? And it's like, it's awesome, because I just like to see that. You don't see anybody like, you wouldn't see that in a Kenny Chesney autobiography or a Toby Keith autobiography.
No, they don't make enough money, man. Not for that.
You know, I mean, well, it's like, you don't see them like making a record that they want to make. They're making records that record companies want them to make.
Yeah.
And they're just along for the ride.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all they are, you know.
Well, Clapton was definitely a guy, it just seemed like no matter what band he was in, to this day, he could do no wrong, you know. I've seen him several times, and it's a compelling live show.
It is.
And it's cool to just hear somebody play the guitar like that. And, man, you forget how many hits he's got, man.
Yeah.
I mean, he's had about one a year
since
67 or something. You're just like, gosh, man, even those old 80s songs are good, you know, late 80s hits, you know, like Forever Man and you know, those are some pretty cool stuff. I mean,
and I saw him in June with Stevie Winwood,
second row center, yeah.
You know, with my uncle, and man, it was just phenomenal to see, because he hasn't lost his touch at all, even though he says he has. I mean, his guitar playing is just as spot on, as clean as ever, running through you know, the 410 basement, like four or five 410 basements, and they're cranked up. And I was actually hearing the stage volume in a huge Coliseum, so you know they were really loud on stage.
Yeah, yeah. No
and Winwood was a great guitar. guitar player, but I mean,
deaf as a post now.
Yeah,
Clapton says by his own admission.
Yeah,
so he's pretty deaf.
And they sat around and he played. You know, he just played. He played cocaine. He played Layla. He played just all these great hits. He did Presence of the Lord.
Yeah,
Can't Find My Way Home.
That's one of my favorite ones off of Blind Faith.
Yeah, and see, he wrote that one about Hurtwood, his estate. You know, and I don't know. I just thought
I finally found a place to live.
It's good, man.
Yeah.
It's all good.
Eric Clapton. Clapton is God, as the graffiti in London said way back in the day. Who knows? Maybe he wrote it himself. Maybe that's something to do, Huckabee.
I doubt it, man.
Huckabee is God. Go spray paint that somewhere and see if it gets you anywhere.
Now, people would think it was about Mike Huckabee, and then I'd be all screwed up.
That's right. Well, Zach Huckabee has been here. Thank you, Zach, for coming in to do a podcast episode.
Thanks, Phil,
talking some Clapton, catching up, talking about doing radio, playing the game, the changing bar scene. We thank you many times for being here. Well, folks, email me, phil@philpritchett.com, or call me at 817-733-5256. Book the band, book the studio. We'll come play for you anywhere you may be, solo, full band, you name it. The new album, Mark of the Human Hand, and all Pritchett albums can be had at p2tunes.com for just $4 a piece. Or heck, just buy you the drop card, $20. You get the whole catalog, including the new album. That's 14 records for $20. We'll mail you the drop card. You go online and just download them all. No problem. Well, for Zach Huckabee, I am Phil Pritchett, ending this edition of the P2 Podcast. We hope you're all doing well out there, and we will see you next week. Take care.